3121, Weatherby versus Department of Interior.
No, first, oh, for, oh.
When this auditorium is used, so we couldn't have work, especially Weatherby. I'd like this last one. This guy's complaining about being out in the tough, mountainous terrain and the cold weather and everything. He's getting the weather.
See, this guy's going thunder.
Man, yeah. Mr. James, good afternoon.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
Welcome, and please proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court, my name is Craig James. I represent the petitioner, Mr. Weatherby, in this firefighter retirement case.
Is that really his name?
That is really his name, Your Honor.
Wonderfully appropriate.
His first name is Thor, lest we lack for entertainment. Indeed, an intriguing name.
Now, counsel, isn't it critical to your argument that we accept the notion that when the new statute, acronym FERS, came into force in 1987, that nevertheless, we have to continue to analyze your client's job position under the pre-1987 law, under the acronym CSRS? Isn't that a critical part of your case?
That is a central argument. That is one of two arguments I was.
Well, stick with me here now for a minute. Now, what authority can you cite that when a new statutory regime replaces an old statutory regime with an effective date of X, that somehow the old law continues to apply after the date marked by X?
My first answer is in the inverse. There is no authority to bifurcate service in a express position, as happened here, with the implementation of FERS.
Come on, stick with me. Congress changed the law.
He was 3 years under the old regime?
85 to 88, that's correct. Excuse me. I misunderstood your question. He served in the particular position that was affected for 3 years.
Got it, got it, got it.
I would think that the presumption would be that as of the effective date of the new law, that's what we look to. You're saying, no, we have to continue to look to the old law because he held the position both under the old law and the new law.
That's right.
I don't follow that.
Okay, well, there is.
Why would that be a logical approach? Why would that be consistent with the power of Congress to change the rules?
Well, there are a couple answers found in case law. One is Connor, that both parties have pointed the court to, which clearly suggests that this court found Connor to be designed to impact new employees, not existing employees who were impacted by CSRS, the Civil Service Retirement System. Number two, we have the legislative intent, which we set out in our reply brief, speaking.
Connor was those who'd accumulated at least 5 years of service, right?
Yeah, that's right.
You don't even fit Connor.
No, and I don't pretend we do.
Well, then, what do you fit? Come on, you got to give us some help here. We need some kind of authority or logic that you get to be under the old law despite the effective date of the new law.
The second authority I would point to is this court's decision in Watson versus Department of the Navy, where the court ratified the Merit Systems Protection Board's new announcement of its position-oriented approach for dealing with these positions. If, in fact.
That just means you look at the job description at the start of the analysis. It doesn't mean that if Congress changes the law, we ignore what Congress did.
But doesn't it also mean the rules that apply when an incumbent undertakes service in a position apply through that position, and the new statute takes effect upon leaving the position in place at the time?
Mr. James, these issues of statutory application come up all the time, but they almost always come up in the reverse of your case.
I understand.
That is, a new statute is enacted, and the party comes up and argues, we want it to apply retroactively, and we now have some new law that the Supreme Court has finally clarified for us. But I don't know of any case that, and I think Judge Michel is trying to get you to lead us to one that ever says that you're entitled to whatever it is you had before, regardless of what the law is today. Unless it's a vested right of some kind.
All right.
And are you arguing he has a vested right in future retirement under the terms of the CSRS?
I'm arguing he has a right. Whether it's a vested right in the traditional sense of employment or retirement system vesting is another question.
What do you mean a right? An equitable right, because it would be fairer if that's what the outcome was?
No, he has a right.
A legal right?
He has a legal right created by regulation under the Federal Employees Retirement
that
System.
Overrules the statutory change by Congress in 1987?
It seems to, in this way.
Well, it can't be that a regulation can overrule a new statute. It just can't be. It's like saying a statute overrules the Constitution. Not possible.
But the question is what right he has. And under the Federal Employees Retirement System regulations, they provided in the transitional provisions that employees who had prior service prior to the creation of FERS, were to be assessed under the Civil Service Retirement System rules and definitions of federal firefighting in this case. So what we have here is Mr. Weatherby, having undertaken service in this particular position that began in 1985, under the Civil Service Retirement System definition, which of course included both activities directly related with controlling and suppressing fires and maintenance and use of firefighting apparatus and equipment. He began with, those were the rules of the road. That was the job he accepted. And by the government's approach, whereby we draw a line through the middle of his service in that particular position, we change the definition to something other than that which he began with.
Harsh thing of Congress to do. The question is whether they had the power to do it.
Let me, if I may, do Please. A little bit of a Judge Rader on you here and say, I think this is a loser. Why don't you move on to the second question, which really is, the board said it doesn't matter. The board said you lose under either CSRS, if I understand it correctly, or under FERS. So let's not even argue over which one applies. You're a loser on both. What's your answer to the board on that one?
A two-prong answer. One, under this court's decision in Felzine versus the Office of Personnel Management, the judge accepted that Mr. Weatherby performed services like similar to Mr. Felzine, and then turned around in the next breath and distinguished the holding in Felzine so as to disqualify my client from pre-87 service.
And what was wrong with that?
Two things. To make that distinction, the administrative judge first picked up an argument that this court has clearly disfavored, whereby the judge took the position that one must use the equipment they're maintaining on the fire line in order to receive eligibility, or receive creditability, excuse me. And the court said in Felzine that you can't take the disjunctive phrases of the definition, firefighting or maintenance and use, and collapse them into a single requirement.
Wait a minute. That's not the issue here. Your guy was a maintainer and user of radio equipment, sometimes in the behind the front lines and sometimes on the front lines. The administrative judge distinguished Felzine by saying that guy was in hundreds of fires. Your guy was in one fire, or maybe we should count it as four because they were all going on in the same zone at the same time.
Yeah.
So he distinguished you on a quantitative basis. What is wrong with that?
Well, that's the second basis he used to distinguish Felzine. And that was to say, essentially, my client had not assumed enough risk of hazard by attending.
What's wrong with that? Isn't the purpose of the whole statutory structure to, and FERS makes this makes it express, CSRS implied it, what they're looking for is young, able guys or women who can swing from the trees with a hose in their hand and fight fires. Your man, or what your man did, doesn't require that kind of youth and agility, does it?
It does. And if you look at the position descriptions appearing in the record, every one of them require the vigorousness that is one of two issues that Congress focused on when they created this benefit. It's not only hazardousness, but vigorousness. And in deciding Felzien, this court said very clearly to disqualify Felzien, and certainly Weatherby by extension, based upon not having assumed enough hazard does disservice to the statute and it should not be favored. I mean, it's just that simple. And I believe I set that out in the reply brief. So that's error number one in the context of disregarding Felzien.
As Judge Plager is pointing out, the common sense behind this statute is firefighters and those in analogous stress get worn out very fast. So they have to retire early because they can't keep doing it. And we want to reward them and incentivize them to do that. So we're going to give them an earlier retirement to recognize reality, and we're going to give them more money when they retire to recognize the risks that they've incurred in this kind of service. So the whole issue is, well, how analogous to the axe-wielding frontline firefighter is the radio operator? And the administrative judge seemed to go through the facts fairly carefully and say, well, actually, not very analogous. A tiny bit, but not a whole lot. I don't see there's anything wrong with that approach. You can quibble with the outcome, you can disagree with the outcome, but I don't think there's anything wrong with the approach of trying to assess the magnitude of the physical stress and the risk of being burned alive, in the worst case, partly by how many days a year were those risks and stresses incurred.
Do you disagree with that approach?
I disagree only insofar as the other thing Congress intended, in addition to those things that you've just recited, Your Honor, is that this become a career. Firefighting, like law enforcement, was intended by this statute to incentivize career service. Mm-hmm. And what we've done by the application of the change in law in this case is disincentivize Mr. Weatherby's having selected the career.
Wait, we haven't changed the law in this case. The issue in this case is one of fact. At least that's the way I believe the administrative judge viewed it, or the board more accurately viewed it. They said, look, we've looked at firefighters who have handled communications equipment from the front lines and have been in there 300-400 fires, and we've taken care of them. And now we're looking at one who hasn't had that kind of reality, and so he doesn't qualify. That's a question of fact, not a change in the law, isn't it?
No. By changing the law, I meant applying CSRS to the first portion of that service and FERS to the second.
Oh, you're back to point one.
Well, to point one, that's right. Because
I thought we agreed that was a loser.
Apparently not. Mr. James, let me ask you this.
Sure.
As I recall the facts, we're mainly disputing about 7 months' worth of time. I believe it was in late 87 and into January of 88. Now, even if the administrative judge was wrong in not giving him the firefighter credit for those 7 months, suppose we were to say he should have gotten those, and we add those to any earlier credit he got, what's the total?
The total is in excess of 3 years, which is a magic number under the first.
Well, how much did he have before? I know three is the qualifying.
He had 480 some odd days, under 2 years. That would have been enough to move him past the 3 year point. That's really why it's so important, Your Honor, because that the FERS regulation set up that second threshold, meaning you need to do 3 years of first-line service prior to being eligible to move to a supervisory or administrative position for retirement purposes. By the application, or by what I've characterized as the bifurcation mm-hmm. of my client's service right. in that position.
So if it's error, it was harmful, not harmless, and therefore, if we agree with you on error, we have to reverse.
Reverse and remand, much in the way the government
suggested. Do you want to save your last minute for rebuttal?
Yeah, I will. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Hipp.
May it please the Court, the MSPB's decision should be affirmed because it's consistent with the statutory, regulatory, and case law definitions of what is a firefighter. Mr. Weatherby is currently an IT specialist. He was formerly an electronic mechanic.
Speak up a little bit, would you please, so we can all hear you.
You might need to lift the microphone. You're a little bit taller than some of the earlier users.
Thank you, Your Honor. And in the positions he served in, although they did involve some activities that were related to firefighting, he's never been primarily a firefighter.
Does he need to be?
I mean, that's the issue before the court is whether he qualifies as a firefighter.
No, that's not quite right. The issue is whether he is entitled to 3 years of credit as a firefighter. We all know that for many subsequent positions and years, he was not a firefighter. He was a supervisor, an IT guy, and so on. But if he is entitled to the 3 years credit, the statute gives him the right to the credits on an ongoing basis when he later moves into supervisory positions. So tell us about the 3 years that count here.
Well, in the years that count, the administrative judge correctly found that he was not serving primarily as a firefighter during that time period, even in the more generous CSRS definition of
you would concede that you don't have to hold a hose in your hand to be a firefighter or an axe. You can be a communications expert putting up antennas in the middle of the up on the mountains while the fire is raging around you, all that sort of thing.
That can be the case. I mean, there's certainly probably a continuum of activities. Certainly the guy holding the hose or the gal holding the hose is a firefighter. The person next in line holding the hose for that person is probably a firefighter. The person who cleans the fridge back at the firehouse, although serving a role related to firefighting, is not a firefighter. The administrative judge looked at this, decided where Mr. Wetherbee falls on the spectrum, and says you're not close enough to the firefighting zone to be a firefighter.
Well, do you know, as a matter of fact, what happened during the highly disputed seven-month period? Where was he and what was he doing according to the record evidence?
I'm not sure.
You're the government's attorney. You're supposed to know the facts. What was this particular guy, Thor Wetherbee, doing in the 8 months for which Mr. James says he was entitled to credit and the government and the board said he was not entitled to credit?
Well, I mean, he was serving in the position of electronics mechanic.
Yeah, and where, doing what? Physically,
well,
where? Was he near a fire or was he back in a radio lab?
If you look at his firefighting service record, which is page 76 of the appendix, and if I can compare that to my chronology briefly. So the first position for which he's claiming credit in this case, he starts in that position on July 21st, 1985, and he serves in that position through November 1988. The first 2 years that he's in that position would have expired July 85. And, I mean, you can see...
I think you're about to agree with me that the period mainly in dispute is from July of 87 to January of 88.
That the third year of his employment in that position?
Not quite a year, but something under a year in the third year in that position. I'm just trying to figure out what was he doing day by day in that time period.
Well, that's reflected in the administrative judge's opinion that goes through the job description of what he's doing. He's primarily...
No, I know about the job description. That's a document. I've read it. What I want to know is where was he in fact and what was he doing according to the record evidence?
I mean, he would have been performing his job of primarily repairing electronics components.
Do we have some kind of account of where he was day by day?
I don't have a record site for you for that. I'm sorry.
We have to affirm if there's substantial evidence in the record, isn't that right?
Yeah.
And I think what the chief judge is asking, could you kindly point us to the substantial evidence in the record that supports the Merit System Protection Board decision that this gentleman was not doing anything having to do with fires during that critical period?
Except 1 month, June, I believe.
Well, I would not construe the decision is quite so narrowly. I mean, that aspect of the administrative judge's holding, I think, is based both upon the activities and the job description. And I mean, there's certainly specific findings. I mean, as compared to the Felzien case,
whose burden was it to put that evidence in? Is that the government's burden, or is that the firefighter's burden to put in evidence of what he or she was doing during the critical time that they're claiming eligibility?
It's the firefighter's burden.
What was the testimony he put on?
I don't think that he's established.
Have you read the record?
Yes, Your Honor.
All of it?
All of it.
All the testimony?
I've read all the testimony.
Well, my recollection is that he put on colleagues and supervisors who talked about how often he was in severe physical stress and how often he was in high danger of being incinerated. Now, you could have countered that by saying, well, that was only 2 days out of the year. The other 363, he was back at the Radio Shack welding parts. But there was a lot of testimony that he was in danger often, I believe.
I think that that's a fair characterization, but I don't think that the testimony that he cites was specific as to time and place.
Did you have any evidence as to time and place to counter his testimony?
I don't believe that the government offered evidence of that type.
Did the government offer any evidence in this case? You read the record. Come on, help us out a little bit.
Well, I mean, certainly the government did offer evidence. I don't think it would have been better to...
Evidence about what Thor Weatherby was doing day by day in the periods in dispute?
No, I mean, the government did not enter that kind of evidence, which I agree
with.
Well,
what did the government do? Just say, hey, look, we've looked at his job description, and it says he's a radio guy, and that's his main job, and that's enough. Go away and leave us alone.
Well, I mean, that would be sufficient, and the government certainly...
sufficient, right? You agree it's not sufficient. If my job description is work in the radio lab, but in fact, every blessed day I'm out on the fire line handing out walkie-talkies, I do qualify despite my job description. That's our case law, is it not?
Well, that's true. I mean,
okay,
the position-oriented approach, if I could continue...
That just means where you start.
Says look at both.
Okay.
And neither one would be sufficient in itself is how I would understand it.
Let me ask you this. Is there some way to separate physical stress from danger of being burned? Suppose, for example, that his job is to set up repeaters on mountaintops, and every single day he's running up a mountain with radio equipment on his back in all kind of weather, physically terribly demanding. Now, let's suppose in this hypothetical that it's always a mile from the edge of the flames. He's never closer than a mile from the edge of the flame. Extreme physical stress every single day, but limited danger of being burned, let's assume. Now, are you saying it's impossible for such a man to qualify for firefighter benefits?
No, I wouldn't say it's impossible.
Well, then how do you distinguish this guy? There was a lot of testimony about mountain climbing and freezing weather out in the Rocky Mountains. Sounds like high physical stress to me.
I'm not sure how to address that other than to repeat the idea that there's a continuum. Certainly, he did not have a desk job, and his job did require a certain amount of vigor. But it's not the same as the firefighter who holds the nozzle or who's on the very front line of the firefighting.
And whose judgment is it that needs or that will make that will draw the line in this continuum of yours?
The administrative judge.
Why him or her?
Based upon the evidence before the judge.
Maybe the Watson case should be revisited and revised, because maybe it's made the government a little bit lazy, thinking that all they need to do is waive the position description, don't bother putting any real evidence in the record.
Well,
you don't have to answer that. It's just an observation.
If I could, I mean, the evidence is not disputed about how many fire scenes that he fought at, and I think the government...
Is it disputed about how many days he was climbing mountains with heavy packs on his back?
I mean, that's not clearly quantified in the record.
by either side.
That's right.
Then why doesn't he win? If the judge believes the truthfulness of his testimony and that of his witnesses, why isn't he entitled to win in the absence of the government showing that it was a minuscule portion of his work here?
Well, again, there's a qualitative difference, I think, even between carrying the backpack up the mountain and being on the front of the fire scene.
Well, your answer could be that the evidence they put in makes your case for you because there wasn't enough evidence that he did enough. Is that what you're trying to tell us?
I believe that's what I'm trying to say, is that the total number of fire scenes, which is not disputed, is not sufficient. And it's very different from the Felzine case in which there were hundreds of fires.
Yeah, but Felzine didn't turn only on how many fires that guy fought. It also turned on the physical stress of what he did most days. So that's why I'm asking about the mountain climbing in freezing weather.
Some people do that because they think it's skiing.
All right, well, Mr. Hibb, I think we have your case clearly in mind. Let's hear a little rebuttal from Mr. James.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Is there any real dispute over the number of times your man did what he did?
No, there's none. So there's no challenge.
The evidence is what it is in the record.
That's exactly right. And, in fact, in the record, on the firefighting record at pages 77 and 78, I counted during Mr. Hipp's comments. There were 11 fires, many of which went days.
So the question is, it's a judgment call as to whether that's enough on the continuum.
Which takes us back to my comments earlier with regard to whether assumption of enough hazard is really the test or not. And Felzine seems to say it's not in this regard. Secondly, just to address the evidentiary question, the government did put on a witness, a personnel manager who reviewed my client's official personnel file and set about to offer opinions that ultimately were not admissible for the most part.
Because they don't record in the personnel file each time he goes out and puts up an antenna.
That's right. Essentially, this person was going to tell us what the position description said.
Yeah. Okay. Right. We thank both counsel. I think we have the positions clearly in mind. Appreciate it. We'll take the case under advisement.
All right. Stay here.
Just for a minute.
Close. We're
supposed to go down and take a photo.
What are we supposed to do? What do you want? He wants us.